This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Hello, I'm Sumi Somaskanda from the Global Story Podcast. Kamala Harris and Donald Trump offer two very different views on climate change. One of them will lead the world's greatest producer of fossil fuels and have the power to reshape global climate action. So what would a Harris or Trump presidency mean for the climate crisis? The Global Story brings you fresh takes and smart perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, I'm James Kamarasamy. Thank you for downloading the BBC's World Tonight podcast for Monday, the 7th of October. As Israel marks the first anniversary of the Hamas attacks, we'll reflect on the events of that day and the war that's followed with a survivor of the attack, the British brother of one of its victims, who's still holding out hope for the release of his abducted brother-in-law, and a Palestinian journalist who has reported on and lived through a year of bloodshed in Gaza. We'll also discuss the impact on the British Jewish population with the Booker Prize-winning novelist Howard Jacobson, plus the winner of the Nobel Prize for Medicine, and a call for the NHS to urgently improve the care of people living with ME. Israel has marked the first anniversary of the deadliest attack on its soil, with silence, tributes, and dance music. That was the last track played at the Nova Music Festival before fighters from Hamas, designated a terrorist organisation by the UK and other Western governments, attacked and killed around 300 people there. Today, it was played at a memorial ceremony at the site of that festival in southern Israel, one of several events held across the country as Israelis remember the 1,200 people who were killed a year ago today, as well as the many others who were abducted and later died in captivity. A day of national remembrance, but for some, a very personal one.
We lost our son here. He was at the party. He was murdered in 9 o'clock and 20 minutes. We don't know. It seems to be like yesterday was the last day we saw him. For us, yesterday was the last day of the old life.
Father there, speaking of the exact time that his son was killed. In Tel Aviv, men and women blew traditional shofar horns to mark the moment the attack began. And the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu spoke at a monument in Jerusalem for the victims and fallen soldiers.
On this day, in this place, and in many places in our country, we remember our dead, our hostages, whom we are obligated to bring back, and our heroes, who fell in defence of the homeland and the country. We went through a terrible massacre a year ago, and we stood up as a people like a lion.
Across the world, leaders have also remembered the horrors of last year.
El Mole Rachamim Shochem Bamromim.
A rabbi chanted a Jewish prayer at the White House, where President Biden said far too many civilians had suffered since what he called the unspeakable brutality of the Hamas assault. And in the Commons this afternoon, Keir Starmer spoke about those still being held in Gaza and the relatives campaigning for their release.
So I say again, the hostages must be returned immediately and unconditionally. They will always be uppermost in our minds. And I pay tribute again to the families for their incredible dignity and determination.
Later in the programme, we'll be hearing from one British relative of a hostage still thought to be in Gaza and from the Booker Prize-winning novelist Howard Jacobson. But first, let's speak to our international editor, Jeremy Bowen, who joins us now from Jerusalem. Jeremy, what has the day been like in Israel?
Well, for Israelis, it's been a day of a great deal of reflection and thought and memories. And what many Israelis have said is that the trauma hasn't really ended. It doesn't perhaps feel like an anniversary, because that's a, you know, finite period of time, when actually a lot of them feel like it only happened yesterday. So I think that there is now a lot of, still, it's brought back an awful lot of sadness, but for a lot of people, not just those who are directly involved with families involved, that sadness and trauma never went away.
And more than one commemorative ceremony today. What has that reflected?
It reflects the fact this is a very divided country. They're not divided about, as they see it, fighting for their existence against, perhaps against Iran or against Iran's proxies. And they're not divided about the idea that Hamas were coming in to kill them because they were Jews and, if possible, to destroy their state ultimately as well. They're not divided about that. What they are divided about are, first of all, the Prime Minister. His poll numbers have got a lot better since they went on the offensive in Lebanon, but he's still a very controversial character because a lot of people blame him for the security lapses that basically allowed Hamas to quite easily breach the border. But as well as that, it's the hostage issue. There's a lot of anger among certain numbers of the hostage families about what they see as, well, more than foot dragging by the government in terms, and by Mr. Netanyahu, in terms of trying to do a deal for a ceasefire with Hamas, which would include the release of hostages, perhaps for Palestinian prisoners. The accusation that they make is that he actually didn't want to do that. He wanted to prolong the war for his own political reasons, so he could stay in power, so he could postpone further a serious trial for corruption that he's facing. So when Keir Starmer stood up in the House of Commons and said the hostages are always uppermost in our minds, the complaint of hostage families here is that they're not always uppermost in Prime Minister Netanyahu's mind.
And the war continues on several fronts. An air raid sirens heard above Tel Aviv tonight.
Yes, rockets coming in from Lebanon, and they were knocked out or fell on open ground, knocked up by their defence systems. And the war continuing in Gaza. The UN and various humanitarian organisations have issued numbers of statements absolutely condemning what happened to the Israelis on the 7th of October, but then going on to say that the citizens of Gaza have been subjected to an absolute hell in terms of a humanitarian crisis. Nearly 42,000 dead, according to the Hamas-run health ministry, which is in the past anyway, was normally considered to have pretty reliable figures. Something like 60% of the casualties, the UN estimates, are children. Perhaps 10,000 people, bodies of 10,000, unrecovered under the rubble. 60% of the buildings destroyed. So enormous damage, enormous suffering.
Jeremy, many thanks. Our international editor, Jeremy Bowen, there in Jerusalem. Well, we will hear from Gaza shortly, but as the attacks were unfolding a year ago today, our colleagues at the BBC World Service programme NewsHour spoke to someone who was caught up in it all. Bar Mizrahi is an Israeli medical student who'd taken refuge in a safe room at his parents' house on Kibbutz Gevim in southern Israel.
We heard that a lot of people are dying, and we saw a lot of tourists going from door to door and just killing people. So we are staying in a safe room. We closed the door. My dad is also kind of a carpenter, so he closed the handle and no one can enter from outside. And now we already hear, as you can hear, I don't know if you hear it, but all the bombs.
That was Bar speaking a year ago. He and his family were eventually rescued by the IDF a day and a half later. He's currently in New York, and earlier this evening, I caught up with him.
I remember last time we were talking to you a minute after we barricaded the entire house. And then we got inside the shelter, and I was putting my head outside a bit of the shelter door to get enough Wi-Fi so I can talk to you guys and try to deliver our experience.
And you delivered it very vividly and very calmly, but I guess your heart must have been beating very fast.
Yeah, there is nothing like a group of terrorists to make your heart beating very fast. Usually, you know, when you grow up with rockets your entire life, and you have 20 seconds to run to a shelter whenever they shoot at you, you know how to stay calm in those situations.
Just remind us, how long were you in that shelter? How long were you waiting there?
36 hours.
36 hours. And could you hear what was happening outside? What sort of contact did you have with the outside world?
We heard a lot of shootings, and they were coming and going. They were getting really closer from a lot of sides of our kibbutz. And every time we got a signal, we got a new message about a friend or a member of the community that was brutally murdered, and about people that were missing.
And you were eventually rescued by the IDF. Can you tell us what that was like?
So the IDF arrived to our kibbutz, and they told us to still stay in the shelter. They told us the minute we could go outside to the cars. Then we were driving with my mom's car. I was driving from a small road. We were passing some bodies of people that were murdered. And then I was driving like a crazy person to Tel Aviv, to my girlfriend. We had this fear of having terrorists with anti-tanks missiles, and we needed to drive really fast.
You were good enough to talk to us again a month later. And I know you talked about still hearing the alarms, the bombs in your ear. I wonder now, a year on, is that still with you?
Sometimes. It depends on the trigger. It depends. Sometimes there is a trigger. It can meet me in the hospital. It can meet me in the university. We have to, as a society, we have to find the tools to continue to function. Luckily, I have a good safety net, and myself as well, I think I found tools to feel better whenever I have those situations, even though I know about a lot of people that survived, that they are still in living hell. A lot of people say that the process of getting better, it's starting with bringing the hostages back.
Tell us a bit about your family. They moved to the north of Israel, didn't they? Where are they living now?
They came back to the kibbutz. My parents came back whenever it was possible to come back. On March or April, it was possible to come and live back in the kibbutz again. We lost so much of the community. We lost a lot of our belief in the other side. And it's really hard to live on the Gazan border right now, because we used to see them as friends. And now we see them as a terror organization that, execute our hostages every single day that pass.
Just one final thought. You said before October the 7th, you thought of the people in Gaza as friends. I wonder what your thoughts are for those in Gaza who are nothing to do with Hamas, who are innocent, who have been caught up in the war in the same way that you were.
You know, Jamie, we were starting to make an article about the people in Gaza that used to work in the kibbutz, and turn out that a lot of them gathered intelligence and took our phones in order to and provided to Hamas for the October 7th. And it happens in a lot of kibbutzes. I really hope that there are people that are not involved in Hamas, but I hope that they will take down this government of terrorists, Islamic radicals, and make a peaceful government that want to coexist with Israel. I have a hard time to believe right now that the citizens in Gaza are really want to achieve peace, because right now Hamas is still in order. And every time that we are trying to make a new government, I don't want to make a new government over there. We just want them to have a new democracy without Hamas. Hamas is just rising up to power again. So I really hope that the people in Gaza would like to live in peace with us. I know that we want to live in peace with the entire Middle East. And I hope that they will get the... I know that Hamas is taking the humanitarian aid every single time. I hope that they will get all the humanitarian aid they need without Hamas taking that from them.
That was Bar Mezrahi, who survived the Hamas attack last year. Well, for residents of Gaza, the attacks brought a year of immense suffering as Israel struck back. The UN reports nearly 42,000 people have been killed in the past year in Gaza, quoting figures from the Hamas-run Gaza Health Ministry. In recent days, Israel has sent tanks back into the north of the Gaza Strip and urged residents there to leave. It has also struck a number of targets which it says Hamas is using as command and control centres. Well, Israel is not allowing international journalists from media organisations, including the BBC, independent access to Gaza. So we have turned to local journalists such as Rada Auda for an insight into what's been happening there. When I spoke to her earlier in central Gaza, she gave me her reflections on the past year.
I've been suffering a lot, a continuous displacement, suffering from famine, from hunger, from movement, trying to sleep well, trying to find good food, trying to find water, actually, which affects my health. 2 million people, they are suffering from the same and lack of everything.
And how many different places have you had to live over the last year?
Well, maybe 5, 6, 7. I was like starting from north to a place called El Mughraqa. Then I had to move to Khan Yunis, then Rafah, then to the middle area. And between them, I spent some days in some of my friend houses or tents or my brother's. It's not a stable situation.
And you have lost, I think, quite a few family members over the past year.
Yeah, I lost my brother. I lost my father also. My brother with his wife and with their daughter. And still for this moment, we couldn't find their bodies. They're still under the rubble.
And how long has that been?
It was from last November.
So almost a year and you still haven't found the bodies?
Yeah. Yes, we didn't. Even my father's body, it was buried in the street. But after that, after the ground invasion and last June in Jabalia camp, after they finished the operation there, some relatives, some friends, they went to see the grave. They didn't find my father.
Can you tell us a bit more about what's been happening today? What's happening in northern Gaza at the moment?
Actually, there were evacuation orders again from the Israeli sides in North Gaza. They obliged the people to leave to other places to evacuate to Al-Mawasi. And already they threw some leaflets ordering them to leave. People there, they refused to leave, actually. That's why there are too much casualties from North Gaza. And even if they want to come to south of Gaza, maybe the situation a little bit is good, but it's not safe.
Can I ask you about the presence of Hamas? Because Israel says it is still striking at Hamas targets, people who are trying to fire rockets into Israel. Mm-hmm. What do you see? Do you see Hamas still operating, being able to attack Israel?
There are some fighting between the Israelis and Hamas in North Gaza. There are some clashes between Hamas militant and the Israelis also in the south.
And how do the people you talk to, how do the citizens of Gaza feel about that?
They want both sides to end the fighting, and not only for the Israelis, also for Hamas, just to save the rest of the people's lives, you know?
So the people of Gaza, you think they blame Hamas as well as Israel for what's happening?
They don't blame Hamas by itself. They blame both sides. Even they blame, like, Arab countries, international community.
Khad, I know you have children who live with their father in a different part of Gaza. Does that make it more difficult for you to make a decision about whether to stay or to leave?
My decision of staying in Gaza because of them. I don't want to leave until I make sure they are okay. The war is ended and they are okay. I hope, like, I don't know, maybe after the evacuation of North Gaza, they will be able to come. I'm here to be with them. I'm here on the same spot of the ground of Gaza. I can call them, but if I'm outside of Gaza, you know, because of interruption of Wi-Fi and connection, I cannot know more about them. For now, I'm not thinking of leaving Gaza, but we will see what will happen in the upcoming future.
That was a journalist, Rada Auda, speaking to me from central Gaza. We'll be returning to the anniversary of the October the 7th attacks later on in the programme.
Hello, I'm Sumi Somaskanda from the Global Story podcast. Kamala Harris and Donald Trump offer two very different views on climate change. One of them will lead the world's greatest producer of fossil fuels and have the power to reshape global climate action. So what would a Harris or Trump presidency mean for the climate crisis? The Global Story brings you fresh takes and smart perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
Let's turn to other matters now, because the Health Secretary, Wes Streeting, needs to, quote, urgently address the, quote, non-existent care for people with ME or chronic fatigue syndrome. That's the finding in today's Prevention of Future Deaths reports, based on the case of Maeve Boothby O'Neill, who became malnourished and eventually died at the age of 27 because doctors were, in the coroner's words, unable to treat the consequences of her severe ME. The report by the coroner, Deborah Archer, highlights a lack of specialist hospital beds and expertise about a poorly understood condition whose symptoms, or similar ones to it, are experienced by an estimated 1.3 million people in the UK. Karen Hargrave is the founder of the There for ME campaign group. Both she and her husband, James, developed ME after contracting COVID-19.
So I got sick sort of over 4 years ago now, and luckily these days my symptoms are pretty mild. But my husband got sick around 2.5 years ago, and he, unfortunately, he deteriorated very, very rapidly throughout last year, to the point that he's now completely dependent on full-time care. He's fully bedbound at the moment, and he has these difficulties swallowing. And he also has very severe cognitive difficulties, sort of to the extent that, unfortunately, he's not able to have a conversation.
Well, joining us now, Sonia Chowdhury, who's CEO of Action for ME and chair of the World ME Alliance. Good evening.
Good evening.
Why is so little known about ME?
We know that there's been a paucity of research. We do not have the scientific knowledge that exists with other illnesses. And despite recognising that there are challenges around funding the research, things just haven't changed over the last decade and beyond that. Alongside this, there is still stigma that some people experience, and this can significantly impact people's care.
Is this report, which I think is the first of its kind for a case that has been directly linked, a death that's been directly linked to ME, could this make a difference?
It's certainly a landmark report. There has been previous situation where death has been attributed to ME, but to have a report of this nature that requires response from the recipients of the report is certainly a first, and it's one that we hope will finally see things change.
It points at this lack of expertise, but also lack of specialist beds. Are there other areas that you would highlight?
There are many areas. Many people have been left without supporting care, not just in the health service, but within social care. We hear of children and families subjected to unnecessary child protection proceedings, people who experience difficulties in accessing the benefits that they desperately need. I think it's very unusual to hear of an illness where the most severely affected are often the most severely neglected, and it's about time things changed.
Well, it's, I think, 2.5 years ago since the then Health Secretary, Sajid Javid, said there would be a delivery plan for ME. What has happened to that?
Well, that's a good question. An interim plan was launched after huge input from ourselves and other charities, people with ME and others. And the interim delivery plan was put out for public consultation. It had a massive response. And I know that the Department of Health and Social Care have been working through those responses. Once the election was announced, things were paused, understandably, but we've not had any real update. We're led to believe that something should be launched in autumn, but we've had no recent news on it.
And there has been a statement from the DHSC. It is important we learn the lessons from every Prevention of Future Deaths report, and we will consider the report carefully before responding appropriately. And briefly, what do you think an appropriate response would be?
Well, we need a coordinated response to the four areas of concern. The delivery plan could drive this. And at its heart, we need to see a strategic approach to research funding so that we get the scientific knowledge that's needed and treatments can be identified.
Sonia Chowdhury, CEO of Action for ME and chair of the World ME Alliance, thanks very much. Now, if all of our cells carry the same DNA, why do some of them, for example, nerve and muscle cells, perform different functions? Well, part of the explanation for that came with the discovery in 1993 of microRNA molecules, which help cells to control which proteins they produce. And that has important implications for the study of diseases such as cancers. And it was for that work that two US scientists, Victor Ambros and Gary Rufkin, were awarded the Nobel Prize in Physiology or Medicine today. And I asked Victor Ambros how it felt to be a Nobel Prize winner.
I'm unaccustomed to the feeling, to say the least. You know, I'm filled with happiness. It's particularly great to know that the kind of research that Gary Rufkin and I, you know, have been doing, you know, using a model organism to explore developmental mechanisms, you know, is being recognized in this way. We're proud of people in our labs who've done the work, and we're proud of our institutions that support us. We're proud of the fact that the support from the NIH of the U.S. has been there for us. We're grateful for that. So there's a lot of thoughts I have about celebrating, sharing happiness with others who matter to me, and also giving a shout out to the support system that enabled us to do this work.
And I understand that you didn't immediately find out. It took a little time to get through to you the message.
Yeah, it's a slightly embarrassing story because I turned off my phone the night before, and so the poor folks who were trying to call from Sweden kept getting bounced back. And so somebody finally called my son. And so then he called us on another line.
Well, tell us a little bit, if you can, to in a way that the layman can understand, what is it that you and Gary Rufkin discovered, and what is it that has been recognized with this prize?
Well, we discovered a means by which, you know, in animal and plant cells, certain genes regulate the activity of other genes in a way to enable the development of the organism to be, you know, coherent. The agents of this regulation are a surprisingly short little copy of a surprisingly tiny little gene. And that's why they're called microRNAs, because they're only, 20 nucleotides long. So at the time that we found this, it was actually quite surprising to see that such a small bit of the genome could have such a specific and impactful effect on the expression of another part of the genome. But we were able to show that this works by complementary base pairing. So the same rules that hold the strands of the DNA in our genomes together also is employed to enable the small bit of one part of the genome to carry out meaningful and important regulation of another part of the genome.
And what is the implication of your finding? Where does it take research into medicines, into the treatment of diseases?
Well, since we made this initial discovery, you know, we discovered these small RNAs in a model animal, C. elegans. But since then,
a little worm.
A little worm. The study of this worm as a model was actually initiated by Sydney Brenner, you know, in Britain back in the early 70s. Now, since the original discovery, there's been many, many studies of the roles of microRNAs in various contexts. One example is the understanding that some of these microRNAs are actually critical for controlling the proliferation of cells, and essentially all cells of our body. And so indeed, the microRNA that Gary Rufkin discovered, LET7, is a tumor suppressor, meaning that it normally functions to prevent overproliferation of tissues, and it's critical for enabling cells to differentiate during development or during healing or tissue regeneration. And in some cancers, LET7 is recognized to be, by its absence, promoting the cancer.
Nobel Prize winner Victor Ambros. Well, let's return to our main story tonight, the first anniversary of the October the 7th attacks by Hamas. Joining us now from Bridgend is Steve Brisley. His sister Leanne and his nieces, 16-year-old Noya and 13-year-old Yahal, were murdered when Hamas stormed into their home in the kibbutz Be'eri. Steve's brother-in-law Eli and Eli's brother Yossi were taken hostage. Yossi was killed in captivity in January. His body is still being held in Gaza, and as far as the family is aware, Eli is still alive. Steve, good evening.
Good evening, James.
How have you and your family marked today?
Well, my parents are actually in Israel. They've gone to Kibbutz Be'eri, where my sister and nieces and Ellie lived. So they've joined in with the kibbutz community there to mark it with various ceremonies and to mark the occasion. Myself, my wife, and my two teenage daughters, who were almost exactly the same age as my two nieces, we went to the memorial bench that we've had placed on the coast here in South Wales for Leanne and the girls. Just spent some time there, a bit of quiet reflection, obviously a few tears, but we then went and visited a few of the places that they loved and just sort of exchanged stories and memories to try and to celebrate their lives rather than focusing on our loss too much.
And some of the focus, at least, I guess, continues to be on whether or not Ellie can be brought out of Gaza alive. What do you know? What are you hearing? Because you do meet with the Prime Minister, the Foreign Secretary. I think you met them last week. What are you being told?
I mean, in terms of information about Ellie, we've not had anything at all since last November, when it was simply confirmed that he was known to be a hostage in Gaza. So in terms of tangible information about Ellie, absolutely nothing at all. As far as the wider issue of the hostages and the attempts to get a deal to get them out, obviously we're 12 months on and 11 months on from the last deal. I met with the Prime Minister last week, and our plea to this government is to try something new, to try something different, because whatever has been done over the last 12 months has clearly not worked. I mean, I'm not a politician or a diplomat, and I don't purport to have the answers, but we need fresh ideas, a fresh approach. We need to cut loose from this sunk cost fallacy, where there's a fear of departing from the approach of the past 12 months, which, let's be frank, has failed to achieve the objective of getting my brother-in-law home. The Prime Minister explained to us that the situation in the Middle East is obviously fluid and constantly changing, and that impacts on strategy and approach. But I think it's time for our government here and governments around the world to question every assumption and every previous approach, and to examine why we failed to achieve the objective of getting these hostages home.
You talked about reflecting at the bench that you have had made for your sister and your nieces. I mean, this is a private moment, but you're speaking to us. This is incredibly public as well for you. How do you keep those two separate, or can you?
I mean, it's almost impossible to. I mean, I appreciate that, I've been doing a lot of press to try and keep Leanne, Noya and Yahel's names in the headlines, and Ellie's name as a hostage in the headlines, because I think sometimes it's forgotten about that these are people, these are our family, our relatives that have been killed and who are civilian hostages. But, it's a case of my grief has become public, and I just have to accept that. It means that I can't fully engage with my grief, but it's a price I'm willing to pay to try and keep Ellie's name out there and to get him home.
Steve, we really appreciate you coming on the programme tonight. Steve Brisley there. We're going to end with the thoughts of the Booker Prize winning novelist, the journalist and broadcaster Howard Jacobson. He's written widely about the British Jewish experience. And this evening I asked him for his reflections on this October the 7th.
Actually, it's my wife's birthday, so we don't know whether to party or rend our garments, but we've decided to rend our garments, which we've been doing for the last year. It's been a horrible year. It's been a much more horrible year if you're a hostage or a combatant, but it's been a horrible year nonetheless for anybody who feels they have any kind of skin in this game, which I would have thought is every human being on the planet. What was most horrible to me was, from the start, not just the massacre, which was beyond imagining and goes on being beyond imagining the more one hears. And it's interesting that we go on hearing things. There was a period of denial, and a lot of that denial is now being denied, and we're hearing more and more. But apart from the barbarism of that, what did surprise me and goes on surprising me was the barbarism of the aftermath. The fact that within hours, really, we were getting reports and seeing footage of people cheering all over the world. I don't just mean in Gaza, but I mean in universities in America. I mean in universities in here. I think the first word spoken about it came from the steps of the Sydney Opera House when someone shouted out something like, "Gas the Jews." And I wanted to shout out, "Well, we've tried that." What was astonishing was that people should find in what had happened cause for celebration. The whole thing was like some kind of carnival of bloodlust. You know how when people talk about carnival, they say it's the world turned upside down. That's what I felt. The moral world had been turned upside down.
And what impact has that had here in Britain and on Jewish people in Britain in particular, do you think?
Well, I don't know a Jewish person of whatever political persuasion whose nerves are not frayed, who is not deeply upset by it all, horrified by what they saw, terrified for their own safety. And I feel terrified for mine, although I must say I cannot report anything untoward. No one's attacked me in the street or even looked as though they wanted to, but they might yet.
Terrified because you're a public figure or terrified because you're a Jewish man?
Just a Jew, and anything might happen. Wherever we go to any Jewish event, if we go to an event in a Jewish school or in a synagogue, there are guards. There always were security people there, but there are more now. There is a deep upset to see the footage that we've been seeing on television. We don't want to see Palestinians killed. We don't want to see anybody killed. We don't take any delight in that. And the shocking thing is, and that's what we hear again and again when Jews meet, who would have thought we would be back here? Who would have thought that the thing that we once believed would never happen? Certainly one of the points of Israel was that at last we would be safe. We believed when we said never again that what had to happen was the world had to be educated. Well, what do you know? It's the educated who have been the worst. From the universities, from the campus, has spewed out hate and continues to be spewed out hate. The hatred of Israel, the hatred of Zionism, the incomprehension as to what Zionism is, the sheer ignorance of what it is. This nonsense that's been spewed out of the universities for years now about it being a colonialist settler enterprise, it was not. There is that sense of a build-up of resentment. And now one has to say it. The one thing I never want to talk about is anti-Semitism, because it's too easy. So I'm not going to say it. I just feel that the Jew is the problem here. It's not just politics. It's not just land. It seems to me to be too much of an echo of an old Jew hatred.
What, though, of the response from Israel and the war that has been taking place in Gaza? And as you acknowledge, you know, you do not wish Palestinians to come to harm, but many of them have. Many of them
have
not been combatants in this.
Yes, and well, if there is a war, non-combatants get killed. I don't say that with any complacency at all. I don't like the collateral damage argument, but that does happen in a war. I knew, and lots of us knew, the minute Netanyahu, he went into King Lear mode. I am going to do such things. And I held my head in my hands, and my wife held her head in hers. And we both said, this is going to be the beginning of something terrible, because he wants something terrible to happen. He wants to show he is master of this. You don't do that. You don't say, I'm now going to wipe out immediately, I'm going to wipe out the enemy.
Clearly, anti-Semitic incidents have increased significantly, but Islamophobic incidents have also increased, haven't they? I mean, what do you say to a young British Muslim who also feels that in the last year their life has become less safe, or they feel more intimidated? How do the two sides find a common language?
I say I feel deep pity for you. I want you to understand that we're going through the same thing. And what we both have to understand is that neither of us is in the right, or only in the right. And I will say to him, do me a favour, come out and have a drink with me and let's talk about it. Every time you're inclined to go on a march, come out with me. And every time I'm inclined to scream at the television and accuse the whole world around me of hating Jews, and many do, you help me with mine and I'll help you with yours.
The novelist Howard Jacobson with his reflections on this anniversary. That is The World Tonight. This is James Kamara-Sami. I'll be back tomorrow at 10, but for now, from me and everyone here, good night.